Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, back with the Vicars of Vegetables. Erwin Goldman and Jim Nguyen, who's in the studio with me today, professors of horticulture in the UW-Madison College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. We're going to be talking about, among other things, grafting vegetables, and we'll answer your vegetable growing questions as well. Maybe you've tried grafting plants. How'd it work for you? Love to hear, so give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Erwin Goldman, welcome back.
Larry, thanks so much. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, Jim Nguyen, it's great to see you again.
Thank you, sir.
Well, I want to start with, before we take calls, I want to start with grafting because, Jim, you've recently come from a workshop on grafted vegetables. Tell us what. Tell us about grafted vegetables.
Well,
tell us what's the background of the. Where were you?
Well, we were at the University of Zamorano University, just south of Tegucigalpa, and in the tropics there are a lot of problems, right? Because many soil-borne diseases. Remember that tomatoes are actually native to the region, so a lot of the pests and pathogens, you know, co-evolved with the tomato. So especially soil-borne pathogens, there's tomato wilt, which is used to be called Pseudomonas, but now I think is called Ralstonia.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and they had to change the name, you know, to make it more confusing. And then they, you know, Fusarium, nematodes, things like that. And it turns out that it's very, very difficult to breed for resistance to all of those pathogens, and that many of the genes that provide resistance also result in, you know, really awful fruit. You know, fruit tastes differently, etc. So anyway, the bottom line is that we've been working with a couple of institutions in the Central American region, and indeed they are grafting on, you know, their favorite cultivar onto some lines that are resistant to soil-borne pathogens, and the results are pretty dramatic.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, I went online to look at the process because I haven't done it myself, and it looks like you need to take some care. With my fingers aren't as perhaps nimble as others, and they're too big and. It looks a little difficult to me.
It's an art. I mean, Jim is a master at this, really.
When you consider the, you know, these hands that are not exactly
and your
delicate.
Fingers are bigger than mine.
Yeah.
So.
But you make a really nice diagonal slice, right? Is that how you?
There's actually several ways to do it,
okay.
And we went through. You can do the diagonal slice, or you can do the cleft graft. You know, really, that's kind of a personal preference. That's the grafting itself is not that difficult.
So you cut a slice, and then you what do you do?
Then you basically shave your scion so that you can insert it. What you want to do is have the tissue sort of mash up, and then you want callus to develop around that, and that's the tricky. That's actually the tricky part.
Okay.
The grafting, you can hold the tissues together with little clips or with plastic tubing. There are, a myriad of ways to do that. The tricky part of grafting is post-grafting physiology, which is that in order for that callus and for those vascular systems to connect requires about 7 to 10 days. And that can be very, very tricky because you have to have just the right light intensity. You have just the right temperature so that you don't get excessive. Mm-hmm. Heavens, you've cut the plant off. I mean,
right.
There's no way that it can, where does it get its water from? So you have to have relatively high humidity, but not too high. And so it's very tricky. It's called the recovery chamber. That's the part that we've been working on so hard in Central America. And I think we've got a handle on that now,
and it
seems to be working really well.
And it works, and Central America or places like that are probably great places to use it. Here in Wisconsin, I know, for example, Young's sells grafted tomatoes, among other things, and It'd be cool. I haven't bought one of their plants yet, but it'd be kind of cool, and especially if the rootstock is resistant to certain kinds of diseases that sometimes affect tomatoes.
But, you know, none of those diseases, except for Fusarium, I don't think even occur in...
Yeah, most of them don't.
So I think, you know, we do a lot of trials. We do a lot of grafted trials, grafted mm-hmm. tomato trials and grafted pepper trials. We don't find any particular advantage at all to the grafted plant. Our interest in doing the trials here is more in trying to determine whether or not the graft will result in any changes in the, you know, the color, shape, size of the fruit.
Does the rootstock affect the quality of the fruit?
It can reduce it. If you graft onto eggplant, you can actually reduce the mm-hmm. size of the fruit.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. The other thing that's being grafted now is our watermelons and melons. And the
watermelons and what? I'm sorry.
And, you know, cantaloupe.
Oh, cantaloupe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And those are used, again, for resistance to diseases. The problem is that you have to use, you know, in the defensive mechanism, of course, in the cucurbitaceae, mm-hmm. You know, cucurbitacin, which is, I think, the bitterest compound on Earth. And that will be transmitted. So if you have a rootstock that has a high level of cucurbitacin, it will be transmitted to the watermelons will be beautiful. Right, but then when you bite into it, all of a sudden you'll find there's a slightly odd flavor. Let's put it that way.
Well, Dan in Oregon has a question relating to grafting. Let's go there. Hi, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I had two quick questions here. A couple years ago, I saw a tomato plant that was grafted onto a potato plant, and it seemed really interesting. And the last couple of years, there's several places that had tomato plants. They said they were grafted.
Yeah.
The only thing is they didn't say what rootstock the plant was. And I'm just real curious on average at the local greenhouses what that is. And the second is, and I think you might have answered this with your previous statements, the professors, is I have heavily clayed soil, and I was wondering if the grafted tomato plants would do better in that because my transplants are just kind of not doing that much. They're not dying, but they're not taking off either. So.
Yeah. You know, to be honest with you, I think grafting... You know, the ones that are sold at the local markets here are, first of all, they're like $14.95, mm-hmm. right, which is a little out of our price range. And I've never seen any. We've done extensive trials over the last 3 or 4 years, and we don't see any particular advantage.
So, because people talk about them having more vigor, but you don't see that.
We have not seen that.
In a diseased environment, they would be better.
If you have root. You know, soil-borne pathogens. Mm. If you have soil-borne pathogens, then you will see an advantage. I do not know if they would do well in clay. I think it's kind of a novelty. That's kind of a fun thing. Grafting the tomato on the potato sounds like a great idea, but you end up with neither tomatoes or potatoes, actually. So the problem is that, you know, I think the carbohydrates are... you know, they're dispersed within the plant, and there's really you don't get either. You think you're going to get both, right? And you end up with neither one.
Or very small plant.
Or they would be dramatically reduced, yeah.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay.
All right, and, you know, this year, just thinking about you said your tomatoes aren't doing so well. You're in Oregon. I know you've got a lot of water because I don't live too far from you. All the water that we've had, I was really glad I had my tomato plants in straw bales again this year because I think that they look pretty good compared to some of the neighbors.
You know, Irwin was just reminding me of how I got started in all of this, and this was because I'll tell this story. Maybe I told this story years ago, but I'll repeat it. I used some land that the railroad has given me. Let's see. Don't remember the legal circumstances of that.
It's just somewhat appropriation. Somewhat of a gray area.
It's kind of a gray, kind of a gray area. Anyway, there was a walnut tree there. And, you know, kind of in my neighborhood, you can't cut down a tree without having, you know,
a problem.
Oh, God, big issue. So I couldn't do anything about the walnut tree. But all of a sudden, I had these beautiful rows of tomatoes. And, of course, all of them died. All of them. As soon as they began to flower, they died. And even worse, you know, as if God were laughing at me, the vegetable gods were laughing at me. You know, the eggplant was doing really well. And of course, listeners to the show know that Irwin and I are not exactly the big fan of the mucilaginous eggplant. Right?
Not as a vegetable anyway. Not for something to eat.
God, heaven forbid. I mean, you could look at it, maybe.
I still like eggplant parmesan.
Okay, I'll tell you how to deal with that.
But anyway, go on with the story.
I grafted them onto, the next year I grafted the tomatoes onto the eggplants. And in fact, it did work for me. In Southeast Asia, we did another workshop there in February in Thailand, and all of the tomatoes are grafted onto eggplant. And specifically because they deal very well with flooding.
Oh?
Yeah, so you can have excessive moisture. In fact, one of our research fields over at Eagle Heights, you know, with all of this excess moisture, is flooding right now. And, in fact, I just checked the plants yesterday, and, in fact, only the grafted ones onto eggplant are doing well.
So there you go.
So there's something that it'll work for, but for the most part, I don't think grafting has much of an advantage.
Yeah.
I could see, though, that, you know, if you're in an area with lots of disease pressure in the soil, lots of pathogens in the soil, you can't use soil fumigants. A lot of those soil fumigants, you know, are banned now. The methyl bromides you can't use. There could be a real advantage to grafting on a world scale. And that's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Methyl bromide was because of the outlawed of, you know, that was a good thing. Thank God, right? Thank God for the EPA that they would eliminate that. But it created a challenge for growers because there was no way to, you know, basically methyl bromide was like spraying a nuclear bomb, right, on your soil. I mean, it killed everything.
Yeah.
So, but grafting is a solution to that. Grafting is used, as I say, in cucurbits.
Yeah.
It's used extensively in, especially in greenhouse production in Europe. There are rootstocks that are more resistant to cold temperatures, mm-hmm. and so you don't have to spend mm-hmm. as much money heating. I mean, grafting goes back millennia.
It's an ancient, that's one of the fascinating things about it. It's such an ancient horticultural practice, thousands of years old. I mean, clearly apple was grafted, right? All the woody plants. It's interesting that it took people a while to start grafting herbaceous plants, right? Maybe mm-hmm. because they didn't think they would take.
They would work, yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gardeners being gardeners, experimenters.
They tried it.
Tried it. And there you went. Dan, I don't know if we answered all your question.
You talked me out of the grafting, but I was. do you know what the average tomato plant at the local greenhouses, what the rootstock is?
You know, I've often gone to they don't know. I've asked them, and they don't know, and they're not labeled. So I do not know what they're using as a rootstock.
Yeah, because they're so expensive. I was thinking about trying to grow them myself.
No kidding, at $14.95. I mean, but yeah. How many?
I've looked up the rootstocks, and there's something called Estimino. Is that the typical rootstock? If you go and buy from any of the seed companies, that's what they graft onto. Estimino.
Estimino.
It's possible.
Estimino. I'll look that up.
We'll look that up. Thanks.
I'll look it up, too.
All right. Thank you. Thanks, Dan. Thanks a lot for calling. We'll look it up, and we'll have an answer here before the show's over. Talking today with our Vicars of Vegetables, Irwin Goldman and Jim Nienhuis. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, Lisa Johnson will be back to answer your gardening questions. So I hope you join us for that. Right now, visiting with Irwin Goldman and Jim Nien, who is from the UW-Madison College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. And we'll take another question. Sarah, thank you for waiting in Reedsburg.
Yeah, hi. I've heard Larry say in the past about mulching tomatoes to prevent some of these soil-borne diseases. And I have my tomatoes in... It's pretty poor soil right now, and I have compost in a barrel from last year. Would there be any problem if I just place that around the base of my tomatoes, or do I need to work that into the soil?
One of the issues this year, because of all the rain, mulching is not the best, may not be the best idea, just because of, well, I should let you guys talk about that. But Jim, what do you think?
I don't really think. I mean, unless you have standing water, yeah, right, I don't think it'd be create much of a problem.
Would you work it into the soil? I mean, you've already got the plant down.
I wouldn't work it in, you know, because you're probably going to damage right the roots, yeah, that are there. I would. I use mulch as a weed for weed suppression. That's why I use it.
Yeah. So I think I'd be watchful. If you've got really wet conditions for a long, long time, there could be some issue there. But
or I can graft them onto eggplant,
which is not grafting, which is such
a much better use of the eggplant. I mean, think of the beauty of that is that you know you don't even actually have to see that horrid mucilaginous mass.
There you go, Sarah. Thanks for calling. Here's Steve in Boulder Junction sent an email, and he wonders if he could graft, tongue-in-cheek here, if he could graft his potato onto a grapevine so that he wouldn't have to dig his potatoes. He could pick them off the vine.
And what would he make? Would he make vodka or would he make, burgundy? I don't know.
Oh, man. That's a good one. Thanks, Steve. Jack in Milwaukee. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. You're hearing me, correct?
Yes.
Okay, I was wondering, I've done that potato-tomato thing years back, and it worked fairly decently, but I used like a long potato sprout, you know, not like a cut piece of potato, you know how the potato sprout in the spring, and then I grafted on there, but I always had a trouble with that cleft grafting because it was like one out of every five, you know, survived and the other four didn't. But I was wondering, do they make something like an omega grafter like they do for grapevines and for, you know, apple trees, small enough to be able to use the small diameters of these plants, you know, for us people with...
I'm stumped. I don't know what an omega grafter is.
Oh, okay. Well, it basically is a metal blade that's shaped like the omega symbol. And what you do is you get two diameters about the same diameter of whatever parts you want to put together, and you grab it and you just basically like cut through on one end the hole, and the other end on the other piece becomes the piece, almost like a what do they call it in woodworking? It'd be a
sleeve.
No, not a sleeve. It's a oh god, my brain's going brain dead. The when they put together drawers and I think they make like this dado, and so that one part slips to the other, so you get this omega thing that holds it together and holds it together. I've done apple trees like this, I've done grapevines like this, and it's like, you know, 95%, you know, on the grapevines and apple trees that you get a
you'd like to think that, you know, as professors of the University of Wisconsin, that we're probably using the nuclear resonance grafting technique. But in fact, the sophistication is limited to a reasonably sharp razor blade and a piece of plastic tubing.
Oh, you put a tube over it?
Right, that's exactly right.
Yeah, see, with the grapevines and whatnot, I found the best thing was the Teflon tape to use for pipes.
Yeah,
wrap it around, and then the black electrical tape, because that gives you the
tubing we use is actually if you buy pure rubber tubing, which you can get, the beauty of it is that you can stick the, you know, the rootstock and the scion together, and you can hold it together with the plastic tubing, and then of course if it's rubber, it will just simply deteriorate.
Yeah,
right. So you don't have to remove it and cause any other damage.
Well, that's why I use the Teflon tape, because a lot of the stuff...
But you remember, you're dealing with herbaceous, not woody.
Yeah, I know.
So,
yeah, I know, not woody,
so it's going to be tough to wrap electrical tape, you know, or around there.
But yeah. I was figuring with it's the herbaceous stuff, you would just put the omega grafter, you put the two pieces together, and because it's such a closely matched, it would callus within days, you know, as opposed to a grapevine or an apple tree, which takes weeks to do, you know.
The grafting tools, I think, are largely for woody plant materials. So I don't think they'll work well for the tender herbaceous stems.
Yeah.
You got to use something very sharp. But there are, and Jim, maybe you've seen these internationally, grafting machines that do.
There's a machine that is, it's actually made in the Netherlands, mm-hmm. and I actually saw it in Japan. And it will graft about, you know, like 1,000 plants an hour.
Yeah.
The problem is, it's this amazing machine. The problem is that the plants, you know, of the rootstock and the sign have to be absolutely uniform.
Perfect, right?
They have to be perfect. Well, mm-hmm. But you'll also find that if you've got a, like we work with a women's cooperative mm-hmm. in Guatemala, mm-hmm. and they can graft 200 plants an hour as well. So with a little practice and the plastic tubing, you'd be surprised how fast you can do it. But
yes, like I said, I've tried that, you know, the what they call it, the English whip graft, you know, where you cut the two pieces at a 60-degree angle, and you cut back on each section so that the pieces slide into each other, and then and that never worked very well. But I say with the Omega grafter, it's like I said, 95% of all grafts. And that's one of those things where, you know, because it's a hand operated, it's not a machine that sits in a place, it's hand operated. It's like a player's.
Yeah.
You just squeeze and then you pop the other piece there. I mean, I did that on apple trees, you know, and close counts. I mean, you know, as long as the scion is smaller than what you're grafting it to, you know, you don't want the scion to be bigger, but smaller. And then you just line up one side and it's almost, you know, foolproof, you know.
Yeah.
Well, in herbaceous grafting, you actually want the scion and the rootstock to be approximately the same diameter so that you can get the match of the vascular tissues. But really, you don't need any sophisticated equipment, plastic tubing, and a razor blade.
Mm-hmm. There we go, Jack. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. By the way, we have open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We've been dealing with grafting, but taking other questions as well. Let's go to Sherry in Madison next. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm growing potatoes for the very first time this year, and they appear to be on steroids. And I was wondering if almost like every answer to just about every question the last few weeks has been, well, because of the rain. I have about 20 plants, assorted varieties, planted in about an 11-foot by 2-foot wide cage that I just fenced in Sunday because they're going so crazy. I have them mulched with grass clippings, and I also heard that comfrey leaves are, the potatoes are happy when comfrey leaves are mulched in. Hmm. So when do I stop mulching? Because they're almost 3 feet tall.
Oh, boy, yours are... I thought mine were big, but yours are long, taller than mine are by quite... probably by about a foot and a half.
Well, I think you can't... Okay, we won't give all of the credit to the excessive rain. Let's give a lot of the credit to reduced temperatures, which is probably why... Why? Yeah, I've noticed that cool season crops are actually doing remarkably well right now, at least in Madison, Wisconsin. And it's the warm season crops that are suffering.
Yeah,
so it's temperature.
That's why. Well, there you go. Thanks, Sherry.
Well, already. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
When do I stop mulching?
Oh, when do you stop mulching?
Whenever your back starts to hurt, you know, when when mulching requires, you know, it should stop.
Yeah.
I mean, mulching won't hurt. How could it hurt? And I love the use of the comfrey leaf, which is, mm-hmm. I mean, isn't that like, I see that. It's like the weed that you cannot eliminate, right? It's like... It's
and
like
the hummingbirds just love it. Oh,
really?
I feel comfrey in a back corner of
okay.
the house.
Okay, I had no idea what it was used for. I see it out there.
I didn't
there.
Either.
Well, don't you make tea out of it?
Well, but that could be a mild hallucinogen.
And, oh.
You know, so I can only guess. No, I was really desperate for a use for this plant because it, you know, it does grow out at Eagle Heights a lot.
Yes, it does.
Where we grow, and it has these giant leaves, and I thought, why? You know, like you can't eat this thing. I mean, it would be worse than the eggplant. So I'm so pleased to hear, you know, I can't tell you how pleased I am to hear that hummingbirds like it.
Oh my gosh.
And that you can rip the leaves off and you can mulch your potatoes with it.
Yep, and I guess other plants as well, but I'm just trying it. And I was hoping you guys would tell me how many I should put in. I just kind of layered, put one in between every plant and then just kind of went around the edge because I didn't know.
I would say have fun and mulch to your heart's delight.
All righty. Well, thanks so much, guys. I really appreciate it.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Well, now we have... You know, it's always tradition when you're on the show, and I know Irwin's got a wonderful poem about onion, before that, I will preface that with a note from Andy on Facebook who says, hooray, the Vicars of Vegetables are back.
Yes.
Here's a haiku about tomatoes with pink brandywine in mind.
Wow.
That he has been saving, let's see. Wait a minute. No, I've got to find it. That he has been saving Masters on the Vine.
Oh, here we go.
Ripening way too slowly. Bread and bacon await.
You know, isn't that the beauty of the haiku? I mean, it's supposed to, you know, generate a mental image, right? A pleasing mental image, right? And so I immediately see the ripening and... You know, the BLT coming my way.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Well, Irwin, you have a poem about the onion, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, actually, you know, maybe we can introduce the fact that Pablo Neruda, right, the great Chilean poet, was a Nobel laureate. He wrote a series of poems about foods.
The Ode to the Tomato. I think we read that a couple of years ago on the show, and you want to read the Ode to the Tomato, or to the Onion.
The Ode to the Onion.
He
has a beautiful poem about the onion, and it goes like this. Onion, luminous flask, your beauty formed petal by petal, crystal scales expanded you, and in the secrecy of the dark earth your belly grew round with dew. Under the earth the miracle happened. And when your clumsy green stem appeared, and your leaves were born like swords in the garden, the earth heaped up her power, showing your naked transparency. And as the remote sea in lifting the breasts of Aphrodite, duplicating the magnolia, so did the earth make you, onion, clear as a planet and destined to shine. Constant constellation, round rows of water upon the table of the poor. You make us cry without hurting us. I have praised everything that exists, but to me, onion, you are more beautiful than a bird of dazzling feathers, heavenly globe, platinum goblet, unmoving dance of the snowy anemone, and the fragrance of the earth lives in your crystalline nature.
Wow.
Isn't that a beautiful, beautiful poem?
Wow, Pablo, you hit it. Well done.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, he captured it there, didn't he?
He did. Makes us cry without hurting us.
You make us cry without hurting
us. Yeah, it's just like my dating career.
Yeah. Well, that was lovely.
Was that beautiful?
My gosh. Well done. Thank you, Irwin.
Yeah.
Yeah, well... Back to from onions, let's go back to tomatoes for a bit. And Bill in Madison has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Well, I got to compose myself a little bit first.
No kidding. Yeah. Wow.
Okay. So that was actually kind of nice. Larry, I know you grow tomatoes in straw bales.
Yeah.
But I'm actually curious. Did I hear your guests a few years ago on your show say that they grow their tomatoes just sprawling? Or how do you grow your tomatoes?
All right, do you...
Okay, I'm a sprawler, and I don't trim them, and I grow them on... I grow them with on plastic, right? Because My principal concern are weeds. Mm-hmm. So I try to control the weeds as much as I can. So I grow them on a plastic, the biodegradable plastic. I use that. And between the rows, I mulch with just copious amounts. I mean, 10, 12 inches of leaves. And, of course, after the years, those have been incorporated into the soil. But I use tomato cages. I use the metal tomato cages. But I do not trim the plants at all.
So you use both cages and let them sprawl?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, I don't, I mean, I take sort of the Zen approach to tomato growing. You know, I sort of let it go.
Yeah. But if you let it sprawl, do you risk more disease?
Well, you've got the plastic and the leaf mulch.
Oh, that's what...
So in fact, you know, the fruit are perfect. They're not actually
and
resting.
How far apart are the plants?
2.5 feet.
Great. Well, okay. Very interesting. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Sure. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have more callers online. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. You know, with all the water, I'm wondering if with all the water, is that going to affect the quality or the taste
sure.
of the vegetables?
Oh, yeah, that's sure. going to, yeah, that's good. The sugars are going to be, you know, diluted.
Right. Right. Yeah. These fruits, and we should say, too, that roots will do the same thing. They're, you know, it's like a balloon, and the more water you get in there, the less concentrated those flavor compounds.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So...
Of course, but we
don't have tomatoes
exactly
yet.
Exactly. And so the real key to that, of course, will be what happens later in the season when you have fruit.
Yeah.
And if the fruit blow up like balloons, then, you know, you could get some dilution there.
Yeah, makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Tom in Superior, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. You know, I'm getting a little tired of listening to you guys denigrate eggplant.
I like eggplant.
We don't get tired of that.
But I thought I would pass along a eggplant salad recipe that I inherited from my grandmother who brought it from Romania.
Okay.
You simply bake the eggplant until soft, peel the outside covering, take fresh tomato, fresh onion, and the eggplant, and chop it up. We use a wooden chopping bowl, of course, until it's chopped into pretty fine pieces. Add some olive oil, stir it up, and try that.
Yeah. So now you've got eggplant. Run it by eggplant and what else? Tomato, did you
say? Tomato, fresh tomato, and fresh onion.
And fresh onion.
Right.
Well, that sounds pretty good to me.
I highly recommend it. I was raised on it, and I'm still around.
And olive oil?
Yep, to taste.
To taste. Olive oil, maybe a little salt in there?
Yeah, you can add salt and pepper.
Yeah, I'd put salt and pepper in there for sure.
How about some cheese? Can we put some cheese on that?
See what I mean? See what I mean about denigrating the eggplant?
I'm with you, Tom. I think that sounds really good. And I am going to try that because I will have at some point in my summer life all of those things, and I will try it. Thank you.
The eggplant up here in Superior.
I just want to point out, there was a survey done in Japan recently among children. They surveyed children. They asked them, what is the vegetable you hate the most? And what do you think turned up?
Probably eggplant.
It was the eggplant.
You know,
it was the eggplant.
There's isn't there so much wisdom in Japanese?
Yeah. None whatsoever. Look,
60% of children, you know, said they won't eat the eggplant.
99% of children said that they would not eat the eggplant, even if mixed with tomatoes and onions, right? Okay.
Don't listen to him, Tom. Courtney in Viroqua, it's your turn. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, yeah. I had a question about slugs. I'm living in Slug City right now, basically. I'm the queen of my slug kingdom.
Oh, and, sure.
And you talked about mulch earlier, so that's kind of why I called in, because I realized, you know, I mulch a lot in the beginning of the season. It was rainy, and then my plants were getting eaten. I came out at night, saw, you know, hundreds of slugs. So I tried the beer thing. You know, I'm pulling off about 200 slugs a night, and I have probably like a 30 by 30 garden or something. You know, I come around and there's more and more slugs. So I tried the beer thing. It seems they just kind of sit from the side of the containers.
So well, yeah. Well, you know, they are actually Wisconsin slugs. So, in fact, the beer thing, you know, it's just not going to work here. You know what I mean?
They love the beer, but it's not really working. So I tried the eggshell, like an eggshell border, and that seems to work, but I don't have that many eggshells. So I really was only able to mulch one of the beds, you know, with the eggshells, and I keep it mowed around, but the problem is that they just keep coming in, you know, more and more slugs just keep coming in, so I don't really know what to do at this point. I took pretty much all the mulch out, but I still have straw bales right up against the garden for the tomatoes. So they're kind of living in there. You know, I put boards on the side of the garden bed so that in the daytime I can just pull them off and pick the slugs off.
This is very sad. Erwin, do you know how to control slugs?
You know, there's all sorts. I mean, no, I don't.
Well,
I know
Courtney's
that,
done everything, the sort of the traditional, yeah, the beer, the board, yeah, having a board out there.
There are plants that slugs will eat that they like better than vegetables, I think. You know, the people grow, don't they grow certain herbs like chamomile?
God, what if the eggplant could be used? You know, wouldn't it be perfect?
It would be fantastic if they would go for the eggplant. But I do think it's something like chamomile or other herbs that slugs will eat preferentially compared to the vegetables. I know people use rodents and other animals. I don't know if you want to get into that sort of thing, but that apparently works with the slugs too.
There's a bunch of, you know, toads that are in the garden that are eating the slugs, and I could just like introduce like a bunch of toads. And I feel like
you can.
Or
frogs, toads. They will eat slugs.
What about those giant cranes that we have out at? You know, I was out in the garden last year, and I was hoeing. Right, and the hawk came. There's a big hawk out there at Eagle Heights, and all I felt was this whoosh of air as the hawk came over my left shoulder, and there was a ground squirrel there, and it took out its fangs and just laced that ground squirrel into a into a corpulent mass. And the only frightening moment was when that hawk looked back at me and said, "This is my ground squirrel." And I backed off.
Yeah.
I backed off.
That was wise. Have we mentioned copper? Did you mention copper?
No.
Because copper apparently also repels them.
Okay.
You mean copper...
Pennies. Just throw
copper,
pennies
on them. People make copper. They make various strips of copper they put in the garden. And there's something that happens with slugs and copper.
Oh, it probably heats up and they fry the little critters.
It somehow repels the slug.
Oh.
But
copper strips.
That could be expensive. I don't really...
Exactly. Yeah. You know, something about the electrical charge, I think. I know there's like some method where you put like a wire around your whole garden and charge it up. But that's too expensive for me to do.
You could try the copper, and you could look up, you could Google copper control of slugs or something like that.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling, Courtney. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with our Vicars of Vegetables, Erwin Goldman and Jim Nienhuis from the UW-Madison College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your garden today on this edition of Garden Talk with Erwin Goldman and Jim Nienhuis from the UW College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, where they are both professors. So happy to have them along. Questions for us? We've dealt a little bit with grafting of vegetables, but we're taking other questions as well, of course. So and we're taking some haikus and poems. So if you want to join in with a vegetable or garden-related poem, or haiku, send it in or read it to us. You can read it to us if you call at 1-800-642-1234. You can send it to us either by email at ideas@wpr.org or on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And if you've got a good garden photo, we always love to see those up on our Facebook page.
We're on the radio, Larry.
Well, that's why we go to our Facebook page.
I'm sorry.
And I did want to mention, while I'm thinking about it, we had a great time in Lambeau Field in Green Bay this past week, and also at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. And today, Jill posted some photos up on our Facebook page. You don't have to be a member of Facebook to see this. But there's some shots from Lambeau Field, and there's a shot of Jill and myself, and I was given a Green Bay Packers jersey with my name on it and the number 50 for the number of years I've been on the air. It's a pretty cool pictures. Mark Murphy and Chris of the Packers president, and Cliff Crystal, a historian for the Packers, have photos of them as well. So join in. Let's go to Dak in Black River Falls. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello?
Hi, thanks for calling.
I am pulling over on the highway so I can stop. I am passing through your glorious state all the way back to my home in Pittsburgh, where we have lots of blessings, including lead in the soil. And I've been growing some tomatoes and some squash and some other things. My roommate says fruits do not accumulate lead in them, in the fruit body. But I'm just curious in general about the safety concerns.
Sure.
About eating those kinds of foods grown in potentially lead, leaded soil.
Yeah, good question. Irwin?
I mean, I think that's right. I think that, there, generally speaking, you don't get much lead uptake in plants. And you would not expect lead in fruiting bodies. So that's true.
So tomatoes, you wouldn't have to worry about.
Not really, but you could find, if there's lots of lead in the soil, and I don't know what you would have, you can certainly get your soil tested. And that's one thing I would definitely recommend that you do, is get a soil test. I'm sure that the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture offers such a thing. You can get lead in leafy greens. And that's one place you should be careful.
Okay.
So we do also have some chard, that we should not eat before doing good testing, you're saying?
Yeah, I think there's a level. I can't remember how many parts per million, 100 parts per million. The level's probably higher than 100, but whatever that level would be of safe consumption of leafy greens or soil grown, plants grown in soil with lead. So I would check your state soil testing lab, get your soil tested.
And mention to them at the time that you're particularly interested in lead, because they'll pay close attention then to that.
That's right.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And great to have you here in Wisconsin on your way to Pennsylvania. Jackie in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. I have a quick comment about the previous caller with slugs.
Yeah.
I've actually had really great luck getting rid of slugs with coffee grounds, using old coffee grounds that have been used and putting them around the plants. They're a problem.
Oh, so you can kind of pile it up, or how deep as much as you can put around them, huh?
I pretty much just put as much as I can put around them, and it's actually great fertilizer for the soil as well. My plants really like it, so.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, Jackie. Coffee grounds.
You'd think that you'd get, like, perky slugs. maybe they're, it's a possibility,
Well, in Madison, you'd want to use a really nice dark roast.
I think so. A gourmet blend might help?
I think so. Okay. Something Costa Rican, perhaps.
Yeah, okay.
Nicaraguan, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. There we go. Barb in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi, Larry. I have a comment on how to get rid of slugs.
Good.
I use pine straw, and I use it around my vegetables and also around my hostas, and I have no slug damage on the hostas at all.
Well, that pine straw is prickly and would be a mulch. That makes good sense, too.
It works.
All right. Thank you.
Wow.
Thanks, Barb. Pine straw, I didn't even think about that. Mm-hmm. Or, as you know, pine
Wouldn't
straw...
Wouldn't that acidify the soil a little bit?
Not that...
Come on, we can deal with a little acidity.
Yeah, there would not be
a little acid
much.
Soil, compare that to perky slugs, come on.
Let's go to Alan in La Crosse. I like that. So we've got pine straw and we've got coffee. Alan, hi, thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. The reason I was calling is I'm looking at buying a new house, and it comes with a fairly large garden with 8 raised beds in it. It appears to be mostly vegetables and herbs that are growing in there. My question was, am I better off to try to keep what's going, not knowing the history of it? I'm a new gardener. Or would I be better off wiping the slate clean and starting over?
Well, golly, if someone has already built the raised beds,
yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of work, and that's like lumber and nails and things. I would keep those.
Sure.
I'm just talking about as far as what's growing in there.
You could probably grow whatever you want.
Oh, you mean they planted the... You bought a house and they left a planted garden for you?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I would...
Oh, well, I think you should send a little bonus check.
I would keep that at least this year, and if you want to change it next year, why, go ahead, but I'd keep it.
Yeah, because, I mean, what are we going to be able to plant? I mean, now we're already into July. We can plant vegetables for the fall. I mean, we can plant brassicas for the fall. That was the way my father always did it. We always planted we always planted cauliflower and broccoli in the fall, but because in the spring you get too many insect damage. In the fall, we would move into the cooler temperatures. I mean, if there's space available in your raised beds, I would go with brassicas. You could probably still plant beets. Huh?
Absolutely, I think the best beets you can grow would be July planted.
Wow!
And harvested in October. Right? They're sweeter, better color. Absolutely. And then you course.
Now, as another new gardening question, an added bonus that it comes with is a small greenhouse. What is going to be the biggest benefit of having that greenhouse for me?
You're going to be able to start.
You'll start your transplants.
Yeah. And do your grafting.
So you've
and
got.
So is it,
go ahead.
Go
I'm
ahead.
Sorry. Well, you
is
can
it
start.
Best to start utilizing that greenhouse in the like late winter, or when is the best time?
You know, you may be able to. I mean, certainly you can start your transplants in there, and you can save yourself a ton of money and grow the vegetable varieties that you want to grow. If the greenhouse is large enough, you actually may be able to do production. If it's not heated, you can do. You could go all winter growing spinach, right? I mean, there are some cool season vegetables. My father used to grow vegetables, spinach all winter under old windows, right? They would be called cold frames is what they would be called. And
wonderful.
If you have a greenhouse, I would think of that. Fresh spinach all winter.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Oh yeah.
That sounds
all right.
Great.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And if you want, one thing that'd give you a little base, you could do a soil test. In those plots, pick a couple of those plots if you want. Just find out what you got in there. But it sounds like you've got a pretty good setup there.
Yeah, I would rotate. I mean, I would try to pay attention to what's growing there and try to plant, some sort of, like if you're planting onions, you'd want to rotate to some other vegetable the next year where the tomatoes are. You're going to want to go to, a vegetable from a different family so that you don't accumulate soil pathogens and insects. So I would definitely do some rotation. But when I bought our house, of course, we're in kind of a low-end neighborhood, it's not... It's not like that. In my neighborhood, you don't see a lot of, like greenhouses.
But I tell you what, there's another good thing. It sounds like, Alan, you may be somewhat new to gardening. The UW Extension, if you go to the learningstore.uwex.edu or just put in UW Learning Store, there are a lot of publications on gardening in Wisconsin. Gardening of all different kinds of every vegetable. There's a fact sheet for it, which are free, and I would highly recommend you go to that site. And horticulture has on the horticulture
That's
site.
Right. You can get through the horticulture site as well.
Yeah, and get there through the horticulture site as well. And it's really a great service that we've got
okay.
here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful. I will check into that.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Just the UW Extension, or it's you. learningstore.uwex.edu, but if you put in UW Extension Learning Store, it'll pop up too. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Judith in Green Bay. Hi, Judith.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Great. What's on your mind?
I just I just had to call in because it's so rare to get a request for a haiku, and I love writing haikus, so I got one for you.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Crunch, clean stalk of green. You can crisp it or thread it like a brand new day.
Oh.
Was this Judith? Was this Judith Neruda?
You have to repeat it.
Do it once more.
Once more. That was magnificent.
Crunch, clean stalk of green. You can crisp it or thread it like a brand new day.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
That's wonderful, Judith.
Well done.
Now, guess what vegetable it's about?
Celery.
Oh, very good.
I was pretty sure it was about celery. Oh, that's wonderful, Judith. I'm losing my voice here. I loved it so much, I'm losing my voice over it.
Wow. Well, it brought tears to his eyes, I'll say that, in addition to losing his voice. Well, thank you for a haiku, though. That was wonderful of you.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks again, Judith from Green Bay. Our guests today, Erwin Goldman and Jim Nienhuis, they are both professors of horticulture in the UW-Madison College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, and Erwin chairs that department. For Garden Talk, I'm Larry Mueller. The Vicars of Vegetables are back for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Erwin Goldman and Jim Nienhuis in the studio with me today. Professors of Horticulture in the UW-Madison College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. Great to have them along. And listen, if you've got a question about your garden, about plants, if you've got a haiku or a poem, we'd love to hear all that. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. If you got a nice garden photo, we'd love to see that as well up on our page. Sue in Mequon, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions.
Okay.
One, any advice on keeping chipmunks from eating my tomatoes other than fencing? And my second question, I thought of yesterday after we listened to the program on jumping worms.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what UW is doing and what might be the potential on the agricultural industry in Wisconsin with the jumping worms. And I'll hang up and listen to your answers on the
okay.
radio.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. I do know there's some research going on at the UW about controlling, but Jim, you had some observations
I noticed last year, obviously, that there was, you know, like a carpet of these worms. And
this is in your garden in
Madison. One of the research plots that we have over at Eagle Heights, I noticed that. And, I mean, it was very noticeable. But to say that they're jumping is kind of a...
They wiggle and they...
They wiggle. I mean, come on. But I expected this year, because there was such a huge population of those worms in my fields, and this year I would have to say that they are basic. I mean, my expectation was that, oh, my God, they're going to eat all the organic matter. And, of course, I have tremendous amounts of organic matter in our, because I use leaf mulch. And but, no, the populations are dramatically down. So I think my sense is that to... You know, like as you indicated earlier, Larry, I mean, these are invasive, and something is going to find that they are, some other critter is going to find that this critter is pretty tasty.
Yeah.
And probably that's exactly what's happening, because the populations are dramatically down.
And I know there's still research going on at the UW about potential ways to control them, but... For now, at least, we hope nature takes its course a little bit as well.
It appears to be the case in my garden. And with regards to the chipmunks, I don't know if you can shoot the little critters. I mean, is that a possibility? But another one is we don't have them wherever I have those hawks. So if there's any way that you can attract those little red-tailed hawks, and they, I just told the story of the one that just flew right over my left shoulder and just took that chipmunk out. But I will say the hawks do not like to share.
There you go. All right. Well, let's go to William and Superior next. William, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Longtime listener, and appreciated the invitation to a garden-related poem. This one is using garden metaphorically.
Okay.
So, wow. It's called Zimmy's Garden. From my office windows facing east, tomato plants stare down a late spring frost. In and out of growing season, I wonder, what feeds yet doesn't fade away? Some say it's spring memories that winter well. Others guess that anything raised inside survives. Of course, there is something to be said about one poet's garden-grown songs. Cross-cultivated among rows of varying climates, Zimmy's birthday strums up from a day in late May marked on my calendar. His words and music, first heard on Minnesota's Iron Range, reach my ears that listen beyond the last fence. Like tomatoes, I too sing along. A long time before ripening under his stage name, he was one note playing against the roar of the world. Unlike tomatoes, his songs cannot be harvested. Still, in sun, in snow, by sound, by syllable, I try.
The metaphorical tomato.
That's nice, William. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much. That's, you know, it's kind of nice once in a while to have a little haiku or a little poem to read. I liked it.
What about, I think, Irwin, we were talking off the air a little bit about celery, you know, the other observations on that. I think that might be interesting to share.
I was surprised to hear. We had a question about a poem about celery, and then, Irwin, you commented that some people have a problem even being near celery.
Definitely true, and that goes for the vegetables that are closely related to celery in that family Apiaceae. And there are people that have an incredibly strong aversion to those vegetables. And it turns out that many people have an aversion to cilantro. And
is
I think many
listeners,
many listeners will be able to relate to the, to this, that many people feel that cilantro tastes like soap.
Oh.
So these aversions are very, very common. And I think they're, it turns out to be connected to our sense of smell. And some recent studies have shown that people have receptors for these scents that come off of cilantro and that come off of celery. And that these particular receptors for the cilantro are the same ones by which we detect aldehydes. And the aldehydes are soapy flavors. So people are smelling cilantro and actually smelling something that is soapy, and this is why they don't want to be anywhere near it.
So they're not going to break out in hives.
No, it's not an allergy per se, but rather an aversion of something that smells really bad. And it's just a, you know, talk about the eggplant. You know, Jim and I make fun of the eggplant. There is actually a website called ihatecilantro.com. And on that website, you will find haikus about how awful cilantro is. Well, this is not because the vegetable tastes bad. It's because people smell a soapy flavor. They perceive a soapy flavor when they get near cilantro. And of course, this would be true for coriander as well, because cilantro and coriander are, of course, two sides of the same coin, right? So these aversions are fascinating. I mean, I think, you know, Julia Child is famous for having a cilantro aversion. And she was quoted once as saying, you know, if there's cilantro in the recipe, I pull it out and throw it on the floor or something like that. And it's just people have strong feelings about these things. I think the figures are that more than 10% of adults have the cilantro aversion.
Well, I have yet again on Garden Talk, I have learned something that I had did not know. Because I like cilantro.
Yeah, and you know, if you don't have the aversion, you can't imagine what's going on.
Yeah.
But imagine that you're being fed something that really tastes to you completely like soap.
Yeah.
Right? You just can't stand to be anywhere near it. And with the celery aversion, they can't even stand to be close to the vegetable because it's so powerful.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
And these are natural genetic variants, right? They just occur in the population.
You know, I wonder if culantro which is a different plant,
mm-hmm.
but has a similar flavor. It probably has the same compound.
It could be. These aldehydes are nothing special. In fact, they're terpenoids.
Wow.
They're terpenoids. They're made by plants for all sorts of, you know, defensive purposes.
And
it just turns out that some people have a genetic variant that makes them think that that's soapy.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jacob has, and Toma has something for us, so let's go there. Hi, Jacob.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
So I have a question about cucumbers. I grow a fair amount of cucumbers, and I have a problem right now with two spotted spider mites. And I was wondering if there are any beneficials that I could use to help control my spider mite problem.
Hmm.
Wow, you'd think with these cool, wet temperatures that it's kind of a surprise to me that you'd have... I mean, that's kind of a greenhouse pest rather than a field pest. Right?
I'm kind of surprised
to hear that.
So I grow inside and outside. I grow in high tunnels and I grow out in the field.
Ah.
And so they've spread everywhere.
I suspect that they're going to be less of a problem in the field than in your high tunnels, right? Because they are certainly a pest within, you know... They like high temperatures and dry. Right. So that's...
You know, one place you might go, because we may be stumped on this, P.J. Leash from the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW may well have a suggestion for you about a natural control for spider mites, another beneficial insect. And you might just go to the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab and just shoot him a note. He's very good about quick response.
But then again, you know, we are in Wisconsin. The blessing here is winter.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Guess what? You won't have any problems in December.
Yeah. No, yeah. You won't have any problems. But I would really try. I would
but
they're
gonna
shoot
come,
him a note.
You know, they're going to come in. But he's doing the... His problem is that he's doing it in the high tunnels, and that's where he's getting them.
That's where he's getting them. Okay. All right. Thanks, Jacob. Ruth in Altoona, your turn. Hi, Ruth.
Yeah, thank you. I have two questions and one which you might not be able to respond to. One is my tomatoes are just growing so slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because of the weather? You know, I was worried that it might be a nitrogen problem. But they're pretty nice and green.
You're not alone in that. I have reports from a lot of people about the tomatoes, and I think the wet weather.
It's the cool temperatures.
And cool temperatures.
Yeah, it's the temperatures.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So I probably don't need to worry. They're just needing the heat and the sunshine.
Yeah.
And I have another question then, which is that we brought in, this is a first year garden. I sort of threw all kinds of organic matter down last year and let it sit for a year, and then this year now we're gardening. And when I brought in some manure in the spring, since then I have seen what looks like almost like a fungus. And it looks like something threw up in my in my garden. And any ideas what that is? I kind of take it out and get rid of it, but
is it? And you brought what kind of manure?
It's like primarily horse manure.
Oh, trying to think of what?
Yeah, horse manure is, you know, that from, you know, that will raise, and that's what we used to use on my father's farm.
Yeah,
we used to use horse manure, and because it would ferment, and those would be our hot houses. That's mm-hmm. what we used to heat with. I don't know what the exudate would be from that, but. But, you know, just shovel it under, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
It, can't be that bad, unless you've got some, you know, the throw-up could be due to neighbor kids, you know? It's always a possibility.
I know, they're fenced off.
Okay.
But it doesn't seem to, like, keep spreading once it appears.
If it grows and grows, then that 1950s movie, wasn't The Blob? If it continues to increase in size, then I would be concerned. Otherwise, I would just, hoe it under.
Hoe it under.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good. Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks for calling. Well, let's go to Brian in Watersmeet, Wisconsin. You are neck.
Good morning.
Hi. What can we do for you?
I had a question. You guys were talking about cilantro earlier, and I was wondering if you've heard of something called culantro.
Yeah. Yes. As a matter of fact.
Cilantro is a sort of a northern Asian vegetable, right? Whereas culantro, which has a slightly different spelling, is actually a leafy vegetable that grows in the American tropics. And these are not... they're in the same family, but
they're
in a different genus.
That's exactly right. There's a different genus, but it is
They have a very similar flavor.
Yeah?
That's exactly right. Yeah, and I think that's why cilantro is sort of taken over as sort of the amendment to, to a lot of Latin foods, right, Mexican foods. But in fact, my wife, who's Latin, she cooks with culantro, which is the leafy vegetable. Mm-hmm. I've never seen it here. But it grows in Central America in the highlands.
Yeah, I think it's only a tropical plant, right?
Yeah,
there we go. But almost an identical flavor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
awesome.
So I bet if people are allergic to cilantro, I bet they would be allergic to culantro.
That is such a great testable question.
We should test that.
I love that.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And let's see, another caller here. You can join in, 2-800-642-1234. Charles and Krivitz. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. I had a remedy for spider mites and for aphids and things like that.
Okay.
If you take tomato leaves or tomato plant branches, crush them up and leave them sit in some water overnight, put them in a spray bottle, and... that'll dry them right up and kill them. Wipe them off, and then you're good to go.
Ah, never heard that.
What about eggplant leaves? Would that probably...
haven't tried them with the eggplant, but
tomato...
So.
All right, thanks a lot for
calling. Pretty clever solution. I have never tried that one.
No, I have, and I hadn't heard of that either. So thanks for that, and... some more callers here coming up, and we're going to get Hannah and Stevens Point up here in just a second. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Hannah, hello.
Hi there. So I just have a quick comment about the culantro.
Okay.
I have recently purchased it, and I've seen it. I'm from Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and I've seen it in two different Asian markets. So... it's really good. It does taste exactly like cilantro, but if anyone out there wants it, you can probably find it in your local Asian market.
All right. I wonder if they maybe grow it in the greenhouse or something.
Cilantro, of course, is sensitive to photoperiod, and I don't think culantro is. Cilantro is a big problem because you can only really have it for about a week and a half in the spring and then in the fall, right, because it's photoperiod sensitive. But culantro, I have actually never grown here. I see it when I visit my wife's country, but otherwise I have not. But, yeah, it's the same flavor.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, love it. No problem. Thanks.
So go to the Asian markets. Let's go to David in Wanakee. Hi, David.
Hello. I have a haiku for you.
Cool.
Wow.
I used to live in New York, and my home is in Wisconsin. So I would fly back and forth. When flying back to Wisconsin in spring and summer, I wrote a haiku.
Okay.
Checkerboard patterns. Welcoming home the weary traveler from afar.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah, I think we can... those of us who travel can relate to that one.
Totally.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. Appreciate your...
checkerboard patterns. Absolutely.
We have Gary from Iron River. He just emailed to say that a good way to grow tomatoes is to put a... He uses a Blackwall car tire over the plant. He's got a few of them. He puts it over the plant right after planting the tomato plant. In the spring, when the plant is small and the weather cool, it draws the heat and warms the soil and helps keep the weeds away. And once the plants grow, they drape nicely over the tire covering, the black, so it doesn't draw the heat any longer, but keeping the plants and fruit off the ground. And it is best to use a tire with a wide sidewall, not a 20, 30, or 40 series tire, and no white walls.
And, you know, and they roll. Right, so that's got to be a plus, right?
I like that idea, and I haven't done that myself. How's your garden looking?
It's very good, except you know the areas that are low. Of course, we're having a lot of problems with excessive moisture, and remarkably though, some of the experiments that we're actually doing involve grafting tomatoes, and the grafted tomatoes are on an eggplant rootstock that is resistant to moisture, and those are doing really well, right? In the because the eggplant is resistant to that, but the warm season vegetables are not doing as well, but the cool season vegetables, because of the low temperatures, are doing very well.
Yeah.
So I think that the potatoes are great, you know, our early season
my tomato
beets.
Potatoes look really good.
They're good, monstrous. But as many of your listeners have indicated, you know, the tomatoes are kind of slow to develop.
Yeah.
And the chili peppers as well.
Irwin, you're a beet guy. Mm-hmm. How are the beets?
The beets are great. You know, yeah, if you got in at the right time in between the rains, you did well. I think people had some tough times planting, and there were times when it was a little too wet. But things are coming along really nicely now.
And are there new varieties of beets out there? Anything new you'd like in this last minute?
There are. There are some nice new yellow varieties that are out there, and there's some nice striped beets that are out there. I think you're seeing more diversity than the typical standard red beet, which is nice to see.
Yeah, that's great. I haven't, you know, every year when I plant, I have different tomato plants. I just go and look and say, oh, here's a new one, or here's one I haven't tried before, and I just put it in, and I've gotten away from sort of the standard varieties, just because it's kind of fun.
Sure. It's experimenting, and it's wonderful.
Well,
I mean, isn't that what gardening is really all about? I mean, every year is a new experiment. It's a new season. It's different climate, and you're testing out new varieties. And one thing that definitely happens in gardening, especially if you're in a community garden, is have you noticed that there's a lot of competition out there?
Yes.
I mean, you'd think of gardeners as sort of, you know, bucolic, you know, folks.
But they compete.
But no, you get... They get a pitchfork in their hand, and you better not walk into their garden.
Right? Jim Nianus and Irwin Goldman are vicars of vegetables. We'll have them back, and we will talk with them once again. Next week on Garden Talk, Lisa Johnson will be back. And Monday at 11, our computer expert will join us to talk about modems and Wi-Fi. In the meantime, gee, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.